accept the reality of the world with which we're presented. It's as simple as that.
Billions of people just living out their lives. Oblivious.
They taught you good. Made you believe their world.
You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer. Because too many others know what's happening out there. And no one, no government agency has jurisdiction over the truth.
Hello and welcome to Beyond the Paradigm. I'm your host, Paul Breckell. Welcome back to all my regular listeners. And if you're a new listener, what can you expect from this podcast? Well, you can definitely expect to be challenged. It's challenged me while doing it. One of the things that comes up time and time again is basically the mainstream narrative on anything is pretty much a lie. Everything we've been told on the mainstream media, you can discount it, you can invert it and believe the exact opposite. But just an update regarding membership for this podcast. I have a Patreon account where you can go on and sign up and be a member. And I think it's $3 a month it works out at. And I've added a new benefit to that tier. I've created a Discord server for members only. So if you sign up to the basic tier, you'll get a shout out on the air. You'll acquire voting rights to be able to vote on what topics you want on the show. You'll obviously help keep this podcast running on air because, like I've previously stated, there are costs involved. And you'll also have access to the Discord server where there'll be topics discussed on there and you can have your own input. You can even leave like voice messages and everything. So that's been updated. And I'm also adding a new tier, which will be like a premium tier. And included is all the benefits as previously stated for the basic tier. But also, there will be a monthly bonus episode for members only. And there'll also be early access to all episodes. So any episodes that are available to everybody, the members will get them 24 hours in advance. So if you feel so inclined, you can just go to my Patreon at patreon.com/beyondtheparadigm and have a look at the two tiers that are going to be available soon. There's one on there at the minute. And you can sign up to either. Be very much appreciated. But I'm just thankful that people are actually listening. And I've looked recently, I think there's now listeners across 44 countries. One of the things I've started to do now is trace sort of where I'm charting, which countries I'm charting in. So I have charted previously in the UK top 50 science podcast. I got to number 20 last year for a few days. There must have been a surge in listeners on a particular episode that caused me to go into the top 20. And I have looked and I've gone into the top 100 three or four times in the US in the last couple of months. Also in New Zealand, and I'm currently number 83 in the science category in South Africa. So thank you for all those guys who are listening in them countries and all the other countries. It's such amazing experience that I started this podcast back in May with literally no platform at all. To go from that to what it is now, I just thank God for it. So God bless you all who's been tuning in week after week. Well, I've got a fascinating episode for you today. People do not know how the world actually operates, and that's clear from my discussion with many people during my daily life. Hear people talking about different political groups, parties, and obviously over here in the UK we've got an election coming up and the two main parties, Labour and Conservative, and people say, oh, you know, well, get Labour in because we've had the Conservatives for 12 years and they'll do this and they'll do that. And then you've got obviously the United States. I know they've got like a presidential election coming up and they've got Joe Biden and possibly Donald Trump, and some people think Donald Trump's the answer. But the problem is this: these political parties, these political figures, all they are is figureheads. They're not in control. Now, within the truther community, you hear names banded around like Rockefellers and Rothschilds and the Astors. And these are powerful families, the banker families. Particularly one name that's often bandied around over here in the UK and just amongst the Truffaut community in general is the Rothschilds. They seem to be like, people say they're like the number one family in control. But actually, it goes much deeper than that. And my guest today has delved into these ancient bloodlines. And the Bible, along with many other ancient sources, clearly record the existence of giants. And Gary Wayne, who is my guest today, is the author of two books, a part one and part two series. And the interview today is slightly centered around his first book, The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, How Secret Societies and Descendants of Giants Plan to Enslave Mankind. And I say slightly because it's such a massive topic and Gary has done so much in-depth work on this that could only really cover a tiny portion. And I had some technical difficulties, me and Gary did, getting actually the interview up and running, and we started it half an hour late because of that, so I couldn't go into the length of time that I wanted to, so unfortunately it was cut slightly short, but it is over an hour. It's a fascinating interview with Gary. You're going to hear things you've probably never heard of before, and it highlights actually that the way the world actually works is not how we think it operates. And that there's these secret societies, that there's these ancient bloodlines. But the climax to all what these secret societies and these ancient bloodline families are doing is basically to get the Antichrist installed into power at the end of days. So that's Satan's plan. And he uses secret societies, and obviously there's these bloodline families and then down to these banker families and the controlling these politicians. There's all moving parts, there's and many of them, but ultimately it's Satan's plan to install the Antichrist at the end of days, and that is the roadmap to where we're going. Obviously the Bible tells us this, so as Christians we're not left in the dark. But without further ado, I'm going to bring Gary onto the show, and I'm sure you're going to be fascinated as I was listening to Gary. Gary is going to be on again soon. And I've also said to him I'd love to get him on a third time, because it was clear from this first episode that we didn't have enough time to talk about what I wanted to talk about. So just sit back, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy this episode. I'm going to bring Gary on now. Gary Wayne, thank you for joining me and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me to your show, and really looking forward to talking with you and putting out some information for your audience on, you know, whatever we're going to talk about today. I think some of the information we're going to talk about is going to raise some eyebrows and create some curiosity. So for the audience, sit back, buckle up, and we're going to spend some time in not thought a lot about. And if you have thought about it, you haven't thought about it to this level. So just kind of kidding on that. But I think people are going to love the show today.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just for my audience, I've listened to Gary on a number of podcasts, and this will be information packed, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy this. But for those of my audience who possibly don't know who you are, Gary, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and what led you to write the first of your books, The Genesis 6 Conspiracy?
Yeah, so I'll try and keep it fairly tight on that because it's a long story. So I'm a Christian contrarian, and I'm not a minister, and I don't have a theological degree, didn't go to seminary school, never had a platform before I wrote book one. And so I come about it with sort of fresh eyes on the Bible, because I had a challenge to read a book that scared the socks off of me, that said, okay, if this Bible prophecy stuff is true, I need to investigate it and decide what am I going to do with it, because I can't not just deal with it. It's very interesting what a fellow by the name of Hal Lindsey wrote. So I did that. And I thought, well, I still can't verify whether he's manipulating scripture and stuff. So that started me on my path back to God and to Jesus. And so I decided I would put all the different prophecy narratives into specific streams so that I could accumulate all of the passages, because I was just sort of riveted by it. And it also struck my interest because I was before this a history buff and a mythology buff. So I wrote down all of this stuff and I thought, okay, I have all of this stuff logged in binders after about 15 years or so worth of research. And I thought I could write a few books on this, but you know, I don't have a platform or anything like that. So I don't know whether I can get published, anybody would buy the book or anybody would like it. So I thought, well, maybe I'll try a short book, which is kind of funny because it turned out to be 98 chapters and over 800 pages. And I left 300 pages out of it to keep it small enough to get published. And so I put the first 10 chapters together really quickly. And I decided to just sort of try and see what, if whether or not I could connect giants, demons, fallen angels and prehistory to the language and those types of beings that are talked about in Revelation and end time prophecy. So I thought that should be pretty easy. And I'm going to focus heavily on, you know, the prehistory part and not so much, but just sort of connect it in. These are all things that we're going to be dealing with in the end time. It's just kind of the thought on it. But then I realized that most Christians probably weren't aware like I was, because I was such a mythology and a history buff, that what's told in Genesis 6 is the same story that's told over and over and over around the world. And that the flood story is on all continents and all cultures around the world as well. Pyramids are, little people are, so many things that you just can't sort of write off as being coincidental because it doesn't make any mathematical or logical sense. So I thought, you know what? I can put something in like Poseidon creating Climene and producing 10 Nephilim kings over the Atlantean Empire and show some of that. And so I put that in, and I did that fairly quickly because I had all of that material. But then I thought, the Christians don't know the context. They don't know the context of this polytheist lens that's talking about the same event. So now I need to learn about all of these different religions. So that took a long while because I wanted to put that sort of culture that was sort of in place with it. And then I realized that coming out of that was the, out of the religious organizations were the mystery schools. And so I had to learn about mystery schools. And then that opened up these rabbit holes and doors for secret societies that were, take their history back to the mystery schools and the seven sacred sciences that created mysticism. So then I had to learn about secret societies because I didn't know anything about that. And that was like well over a decade. So I started writing in 1996. I was thinking I was finished by about 2013, but I started my research in about 1980. So it was a long sort of path. And so, yeah, so that sort of led me to write the larger book to try and tell a story that is more, is very, very unique. There isn't a book out there, whether it's on secret societies, whether it's on bloodlines, whether or not it's on giants, whether it's on prehistory, that connects the whole story and makes, starts to make sense of a global history. And for Christians, hopefully bring the Old Testament to life and give them answers that they're not getting in the churches because they don't teach prehistory or they don't teach prophecy. So that's kind of how I ended up there. And so the book came out, you know, was officially in 2015. And it really didn't get launched until a convention for a Christian publication convention where new books are launched at and you do signings and stuff like that. And so in 2016, about midway through the year. So first year was a little bit tough. No platform, nobody knew me, an expensive book. And so I had to get onto social media and I started to do that. And then, you know, in May of that 2016, I got my first interview. And then from there, it was just boom, because the things I would talk about, people hadn't really connected the dots on or had thought about. So, and book two is going to be just as unique, but from a different perspective.
I can totally, you know, get on board with the no platform situation, because that was my situation back when I started this podcast. Because you sort of think, well, I'm not a doctor, you know, I'm not a minister. Yep. Who wants to listen to me? But like you did, you just wrote your book, and obviously God's blessed your work, and now you've got a platform, and obviously you've been on loads of podcasts, and that's exactly what's happened for me. That I've gone from nothing, knowing absolutely nothing about podcasting, to having an audience that covers about 44 different countries.
It's crazy how that works if you buy in. And I wanted to stop the project many times because I thought this is just too crazy, but I don't listen very well, so I'm kind of stiff-necked, but that calling doesn't sort of go away. It haunts you and kind of until you get back, and then you get some peace. But what's interesting about this book is that it sells more every year. So it's been out for 8 or 9 years, but every year the sales go up even more. And so, yeah, it's one of those books that, has sort of a resonance out there, and people who come across it are, buying it and using it as, they like to read, but they also use it as a reference book. And so it has lasting power. I don't know how long it lasts for, but I think it's standing the test of time, which makes it a longer life book because under research.
I think you hit the nail on the head earlier when you said it's unique. And I think that's the reason for the longevity because, I mean, we love the Nephilim on this show. Like I mentioned to you off air, I've had a few guests on, we've talked about that before, but nothing like what we're going to talk about with you today. And I would say to people that, like Gary said about the research, he's done his research, and this book, you need to get it. And he has got a second book coming out, which we're going to talk about that in another interview. But so obviously in the Bible, we have genealogies in there, and people often find these boring, but we know that obviously they're there for a reason. For example, we can trace the bloodline of the Lord Jesus Christ to King David to show that he's like the son of David. And obviously there's now, we've got people out there, the royals, the elites, that also consider, bloodlines and genealogies extremely important. Now, could you expound on this regarding these royals and elites that, they're operating behind the scenes, but how these bloodlines are actually important to them, and in terms of getting a grasp on actual how the world really operates, like who are the people we should be aware of, like the names?
So if people aren't familiar with the bloodlines and the dynastic aspect of the Nephilim, both before the flood and the giants after the flood, that I don't get really much into in terms of the distinction of the kind of giant in book one, I reserve that to book two, is that they kept their genealogies. And people don't sort of look at the royals in a way that maybe they should, because they like to call themselves Rex Deus, as I call them in book one, and that means kings of God. But what makes them a royal? Like, why do they have a divine right to rule, as they assert? And where does that divine right to rule come from? Does it come from the God of the Bible, or does it come from the fallen angels? And so we need to understand that genealogies are key in terms of where their family and the individual of a family, in terms of where he's born or she is born, fit into the overall hierarchy. And it always has. And so there's an organizational structure that went up also amongst the royal bloodlines that included the religious aspect, the educational aspect, the warrior in terms of leading the army aspect, and the mighty ones of the warriors. And they controlled the, let's call them, as in modern language, oligopolies of the giant businesses. And they populated the top two classes of the four class system around the world, feudal system as it was known in Europe, but nonetheless the same class system that's in all cultures around the world. And that the two at the bottom were only populated by humans. And these humans could, if they were very fortunate, would populate a small entrepreneurial class, let's say of bakers, tailors, blacksmiths, and then the rest were slaves or just labor class. So very much the poor and the mundane, those two lower classes. But what makes a royale? That they claim that they have a divine right to rule, that they think that they have this superiority aspect to them, that they should almost be worshipped like a demigod. And a demigod is known in ancientology as the offspring of a god or a goddess and a human male or a female. And we know it mostly as from a male angel, fallen angel, and a female in the Bible, but in Sumeria or in Greek mythology and elsewhere, they have mother goddesses that also produce a giant. So, for example, so that people know what I'm talking about, is you have a second incursion creation of a giant named Gilgamesh, who also, there's a Gilgamesh before the flood in Enoch, Book of Giants. It's not uncommon to have post-Diluvian or after the flood giants named after antediluvian giants before the flood. That's a very common practice. And he is the son of Lugalbanda, king of Uruk, and the fertility god is Nin or Ninsen, depending on the transliteration that you're reading into English. So we need to understand that they produced prolifically before the flood and then produced again after the flood. And that not only did they populate these the world and took over the class system and dominate it by taking control of the kingships by their sheer strength and numbers before the flood, then again after the flood, they kept that within the royal bloodlines or the larger elite or the nobility class. And so they genealogies all the way down through history, and they would take their, whether if let's say you're talking about King Charles III, for example, who's just been crowned, he is going to take his genealogy back through to a specific patriarch of a Rephaim or a Nephilim. Rephaim being post-Diluvian giants, and a specific fallen angel or a god that is ruling from the council of the gods that polytheism talks about, or the council of gods that is also referenced in Psalms 82 over the 70 nations, both before and after the flood, as numbered in Genesis 10 or First Chronicles in the Table of Nations, and by the number of sons firmly quantified in Exodus 1:5 for the sons of Jacob, as in a sort of future prophecy to that very special prophecy that I like to call a dual prophecy in Deuteronomy 32. And so we have this organizational structure of the visible ones and the invisible ones, and these, this genealogical, gene-based dynastic royale, and understand that, that royale means a king of God, or a king of God, or a queen of God. And just as Rex Deus or Rex Deus does. And so Roy goes back to old French king for Roy, and back into Latin for similar words like regal. And it's understood as a majestic dynastic bloodline. And AL is a transliteration of the Hebrew EL for an angel or a god in the Old Testament. And so Baal would be master god or lord god, part of the Baalim, offspring god that rules after the flood, versus El, his parent god that rules before the flood. So you have this genealogical logging that they keep in the family trees, a phylumic tree, an elm tree, an oak tree, an ash tree, used similarly, but for the genealogical tree that goes back to a specific patriarchal Nephilim or Ephraim, and to a specific celestial mafia godfather that created that Nephilim. And so when King Charles III would swear an oath, he's not swearing to the God of the Bible. He is swearing to that specific bloodline creator godfather in this initiatory system that he's swearing an oath to, that begins with the 200 on Mount Hermon with the oath of the harem anathema to carry it out to the end, no matter the consequences, to create these giants to destroy humankind from the face of the earth, so that humankind can't reach their destiny to be raised up like angels, and to judge those fallen angels for the crimes they did against us and the crimes against the earth, and also that humankind would be the inheritors of eternity. And so there's a context here that they keep these genealogies because it's where they fit in the whole hierarchy of things. And there's many bloodlines around the world. So they do what they do. They do what they call a scioning in, or a grafting of bloodlines. So when you see the coat of arms, and as that ennobling of that bloodline happens through another very ennobled bloodline, that coat of arms will change with the imagery or the taciturn language. And that coat of arms was created, and originally it would be on a flag, so that they, if they were traveling into another country, the royals there could read that and know exactly their genealogy for the celestial mafia godfather, the fallen angel or god, or The specific Raphaim or Nephilim, and the ennobled aspect, it would be also marked in there. So this, and when we look at King Charles III, when he was still Prince Charles, he had gone on record a couple of times and said that he takes his genealogies back to Vlad the Impaler, and that goes back through the Hanovers, obviously, and you know, Hanovers changed their name to Windsor in World War I. And through the Middle Europa bloodline back to Vlad the Impaler, who the Dracula tales are based off of, which is a dragon and matriarchal allegory bloodline, or a patriarchal bloodline, raven or dragon, female matriarchy bloodline allegory is fairy or owl. And that he was a noble Celt by his descriptions. He had pale skin, he had red hair. He had hazel eyes. He was educated at the school of Solomon in Vienna. He had a genealogy that they say they took back to Hercules, son of Clymene, a human female, and Zeus, a god, a post-Diluvian genealogy that, in part, King Charles takes his pet to. And so the royal bloodlines had their own sort of Masonic orders that they originally started that were wedded within those royal bloodlines, and they still exist to this day. So if we want to understand the world, we need to understand that these beings were created by the fallen angels to rule over us and to lead us away from God, to slander God, to not give God credit for anything, and to honor their pantheon of gods. And we see that in everything that they do. And that still happens today in the seven liberal arts that are the seven sacred sciences that created the mystical religions, so that it was kept with that. And mysticism is a knowledge cult, and that was to be kept away from the mundane, so humans or the Sethian line, as that comes out of Genesis. And Enochian mysticism is created by Enoch, son of Cain, who takes the knowledge from Adam, according to the Gnostics and the secret societies and the ancient polychronicon of those bloodlines, an oral tradition, that it's the seven sciences that are put into a mystical ritual oath-based religion, like their godfathers had introduced, just as the ruling nature and everything they put their hands on is oath-based, because they have tender over this world for a limited amount of the time, with Satan being the prince of this world and the god of this world, just to give a little bit of texture to that. And that this oath-based religious system is also part of their organizational hierarchy that we discussed. So all of this is in place today. And what really sort of brings things into mind is why do they feel they have the right? Because that was bestowed on them in ancient history, whether it was at Mount Hermon or whether it was at Nippur or many other names of these holy places where those ring lords were crowned and given that authority. It is called the Assembly of the Datanu in the Ugaritic text that answered to the Baalim that reigned from Mount Hermon, who created the Raphaim after the flood. So this is a long asserted authority, and it was imposed on the world because of their greater size and other gifts from their godfathers. And so they've been maintaining that control and been trying to do the works for their invisible ones that they still worship, and to destroy humankind from the world. And they don't care whether that destroys the world, because the new world in the Shiva tradition of creating a new world out of destruction, the new world isn't for humans, it's for the spurious offspring of the fallen angels.
You mentioned like hierarchy a few times there, and I've been doing a little bit of research prior to this, and there's certain sort of family names that we often hear in, you know, the Trufa community, if you like. You know, you've got like the Astors, the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, for example. Yeah. Now, during the research that I was doing, these are part of 13 families that we think rule the world, but there's another 13 families who actually rule the world. For example, the Breakspears, the Borgias, and one interesting one, which I've looked into a little bit, is the Orsini bloodline.
Yeah, you're talking
Now,
about
as
the
I
Giulia
understand it,
gens. Yep.
is the Orsini, the Pepe Orsini, he's the Greek Pope. And he's like, apparently, I mean, you'll know more than me. This is just during my research, that he's like the true Pope. The white
Yep.
Pope's just like a puppet. Then you've got obviously the black Pope, who's a superior Jesuit.
Yep.
And then you've got the grey Pope. Now, the families, like I mentioned before, like say the Rothschilds, Rockefellers,
So
they're like
here's
the
here,
new money type rulers, aren't they? But there's these other families. Could you elaborate on that? Because obviously you know a lot more than I do.
absolutely. So if we're going to see a name like Rockefeller, that's common, or the Rothschilds, that's what they want us to see. Those aren't the 13 families. Those are pseudo blue bloods, as they're called, particularly of the American bloodlines that have a gene and a blood type that would and bloodline that would be distant but still part of it, but lower level. They are trying to intermarry through the next generations up into the hierarchy. And so the Rothschilds set up in North America that included DuPont, that included the Carnegies, that included the Morgans and the Rockefellers and all the names. These are the pseudo blue bloods who, you know, have the connection to the bloodlines, but were sent to the New World because that's what they did with the lower levels and the multiple down the list in terms of siblings, so that they could put their legal tender over every city and town that was going to be set up with their town square. And I won't go into how they do that today, but we might want to come back to that. But they are not the ones who are running the world. And you can make up 13 of those in 100 different ways, and it's still irrelevant because they're not the 13 families. Yeah, so when we talk about 13 families, we need to talk about it in two other columns that are ancient. One is the European 13 bloodlines. But there's a 13 bloodlines around the world as well. So you can look at the bloodlines that came out of Russia. You can look at the bloodlines that came out of Middle Europa, let's say with Vlad the Impaler. You can look at bloodlines that came out of China, the bloodlines that came out of Central and South America, and the bloodline chiefs of North America. And, you know, most people think that, you know, those dynastic bloodlines were eliminated by the Portuguese and the Spanish in the early 1500s, but they only lopped off the head of the king of that time or the emperor of that time. But by the 1520s, both Portugal and Spain had reasserted their dynastic privilege, though they continued to rule as more or less as vassals, but still they had all the rights, and they started to actually intermarry with some of the European bloodlines. So you have these ancient bloodlines that are sort of in the background, and even with the changing of the world in the last 150 years, in what happened in Central America, they still exist. One ought to expect that they're going to resurface for those 10 kings of the end time, just as the Club of Rome that answers into the Committee of 300 Families separated the world in the late 60s and early 70s into those 10 zones, just as the UN has separated all of the world into 10 zones, not exactly the same as the Club of Rome, but very, very similar. So they're telling us that they're going to recreate that new Atlantis with those 10 king bloodlines in the end time, so that you get the fulfillment of nothing is new under the sun, and what was will be again, and it's going to be like the days of Noah. And Noah lived both 600 years before the flood and 350 years after the flood, and there was giants and gods walking amongst us on both sides of the flood for a more limited time after the flood. Yes, because they did the same crimes and went to the same pit prison as the parent gods did, but they did walk amongst humankind for a while, just as they did before the flood. Yeah, so now we have, okay, so who are these 13 bloodlines around the world? And how are they going to resurface? And that gets to be the real art to it. And there's many bloodlines in Europe that you could look to. And I list 13 that were suggested, but I'm not saying those that's necessarily accurate. Some of them would be in there for sure. So, you know, I think you could put the Hanover bloodline in. That's been scioned in with the Stuart bloodline and a whole bunch of other ones, and Queen Elizabeth, and when it deduces, I haven't firmed it up yet, when deduces King Charles III by inheritance in accepted the role at the chair of the Order of the Golden Fleece versus the senior order of the garter that's in England. There's two levels. There's a higher level of royals, and then there's a lower level that they award politicians with and stuff like that. But this Order of the Golden Fleece is the table and Royal Masonic Council that includes the current King of Jerusalem, which is King Philippe of Spain, Bourbon, that he inherited from King Juan Carlos, his father, and through bloodline intermarriage between the Bourbon and other Spanish kings going all the way back to the Holy Roman Empire, King Charles, were intermarrying with the Habsburg bloodline, who inherited the King of Jerusalem title through intermarriage through families in Lorraine, and that's the Habsburg-Lorraine dynasty. And they have this current families of Anjou, where that comes from. And so you have an Anjou, you have a de Payon, a de Pouillon, all Merovingian and Anjou bloodlines that form the Knights Templar and the start of modern secret societies as we would understand it. But they take that King of Jerusalem title back to Baldwin II Anjou in 1118 as being crowned as such, as the King of Jerusalem, through the scioning in of these bloodlines. So bloodlines through the Merovingians that have a lot of scioning in, that include Davidic bloodlines, that includes King Saul's bloodlines, and as their fiction and literature would suggest, Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Now, I think that's not true, but that's what they believe, and what they do with that belief system is what we need to be concerned with. And that in the time of the Exodus, Joshua awarded Jerusalem to the Benjamites, which is why King Saul is in there for a scioning in. And that's the King of Jerusalem title that they awarded themselves with in 1118. So, yeah, you have to include the Windsors and the Anjou in there. And the Anjou have three different branches, all and two other branches, the kings of Naples, the Savoy, bloodline of the Anjou, and the von Habsburg, through that intermarriage that I said, also make claims to the King of Jerusalem title, which is the Dragon Messiah Antichrist title that they want to bring about in the end time through their bloodlines. So it's important that these bloodlines and genealogies are kept. And as again, it's all in terms of their purity and the ennobledness through those scion grafting is where you fit in that hierarchy. And they have a complete structure in terms of how those Masonic societies are structured. And it's not a pyramid.
It's such an important topic, Gary. I'm just listening, fascinated, because people don't realize how the world really operates. And this is why I wanted to do these episodes with you, because I think it's so important to understand these bloodlines. Now, obviously, you've mentioned Freemasonry.
Yeah. Well, before we get into that, let's just underline what you just said there, if I can. So the best example I can provide in recent history of the royal bloodlines and the rivalries, because there can only be one family that's going to have this dynastic reign. So there's rivalries. They have the same agenda, but they all want to be that dynastic family that rules the world. World War One was a war between the families, and they were all related. They were all cousins. So you had the czars of the Putyanin and the junior offshoot of the Putyanin, which was the Romanovs that succeeded through intermarriage in around 1600, just as the Plantagenet, which is a very famous bloodline in the name, is a junior offshoot of the Anjou. So that people sort of understand how kind of that works through the scioning and where they fit in the hierarchy. And so you had the Kaisers in Germany, again, cousins, and cousins to the Windsors that they changed their name to from Hanover in World War One, and also with the Habsburgs, they all were intermarrying, as did the Bourbon family intermarry with all of these continually. So this was an interfamily squabble for power. And there's a sinister thing that goes on with that rivalry as we approach the end of World War One, and it's something that social masonry that was created by the Royal Masonic Orders in the 1800s as a virus against the Western European bloodline enemies or rivals. So what they did was they launched communism that is comes out of social masonry onto Russia, and it took out that whole Romanov bloodline. So they thought, although Putin would suggest he takes his bloodlines back to the Putyanin, but that's a different story. But understand, this is about bloodlines. And so after the rise of communism, it gets out of control. The Western families and their bloodlines and their bankers, that, you know, everybody looks at the Rothschilds as being the head of the banking, and they answer into the Committee of 300 Families as well. But they were the Bauer family from Germany and only changed their name to the Rothschilds when they set up the London Bank in the early 1800s. And they were funded by the royal bloodlines to replace the Templar banking. And so it's an important aspect, but they're visible. Power brokers, right? It's the families that are in behind as you get above the Committee of 300 Families. And so what was done in response to communism was National Socialism. The National Socialist Worker Party, created through secret societies like the German Annual Orden, the Temple Society, a whole bunch of other secret societies, Theosophy, which is the Gnostic religion of the secret societies and the royales, and created to be the religion that would unite science and education in the end time, is the religion that is going to be adopted by the Nazis. And they're going to morph it with real ideology and grail ideology, and morph it into something that they call Ariosophy, which comes to a full level of church in 1933 with the launch of the Reich Church. And so you have a creation again that's a little bit different than communism, because now you have these oligarchs that are involved, and the ones who are going to be running all of the industries that's working in partnership, and they're created to bring down the communists, which was one of their goals, which is why Hitler was partly obsessed with doing that. But unfortunately, Nazism goes rogue. And so they have to take all of the bankers and the bloodlines have to take all of their resources to bring down National Socialism. And in the fallout, you have the Kaiser's fall, and you have the fall of the reduction in power of the Habsburgs. And with the Spanish War and communism as being part of the Spanish War, you have the Bourbon bloodline being reduced. And so you have this sort of French and English bloodlines that were continually intermarrying in a significant way that are trying to be the dominant bloodlines for what they think is the end time. And they're always reaching too far, and it's never as close as they think until an ordained time that comes about. And if that wasn't enough, they decided at the end of World War II to launch social masonry onto China, because that's another powerful bloodline. And that bloodline comes from the dragon creator gods. Same story is going on all around the world, who created their dragon kings and the Shah dynasty, XIA, and two main bloodlines, Western and Eastern bloodline, one dominated by the surname of Lee, spelled L-E-E-L-I, and a few other different English transliterations, and the other one being Xi, X-I. And guess what? We have a Xi on the throne today who has dynastic implications and empire implications, just as Putin believes. This is all about the rivalries. You want to understand what's going on in the world today? Look at what they're doing and feeding us pablum for the reasons why we have these wars. These are violent warrior killing people from their beginning. They are not... They've split into two groups within the in the bloodlines and in the secret societies, from the white hats and the black hats. And the white hats are supposedly gentlemen. They still worship the same pantheon of God. They still have the same agenda. They're just nicer to humans than the black hats. But the end is always the same. So you have to be careful, sort of all of that sort of language. But it starts to give you an understanding that there's more at play here than what the media would tell us. But of course, they control the media. So,
yeah, that's the thing. I mean, when I interview truthers who are not Christians, they stop at like the bankers. It's the bankers have done that. But obviously, as Christians, we go even deeper than that, because we understand, obviously, well, ultimately, it's spiritual war, isn't it? And obviously, the Rothschilds is one name that always comes up. And during my sort of bit of research, apparently the Rothschild actually means the Red Shield.
Yep.
I think that's right. And basically, they're like front shielding to the true power, which is behind that actual money. And you've mentioned, obviously, Freemasonry, which is, I don't know a great deal about it, but it's something I do want to get into.
Sure.
Because, well, I actually live near a Masonic Hall. It's literally across the road from where I live. And I drive past it every day.
It's a temple.
That's the thing. And I think about it all the time. Like when I'm praying and things, I'm thinking to myself, I'm in an area now that's got like some kind of principality over it, because it's got this Masonic hall, you know, so there's something unseen as well. But in terms of Freemasonry, so just for people who don't know a lot about it, including myself, could you give us a brief explanation of Freemasonry, like its basics and also like what's the Scottish Rite and what's the York Rite?
Sure. Yeah, all good questions. And so Freemasonry is the lowest level of the secret societies that has an adept in it. So there are lower levels of secret societies. And so it is a organization that is similar, but way downstream from Masonry, ancient Masonry. Ancient Masonry is the realm of the royals. Freemasonry is a modern organization that's created after the fall of the Knights Templar, as most of these other organizations that we're going to talk about in conjunction with Freemasonry were created after the fall of the Templars in 1307 as well. So one slightly before. And so Freemasonry was created by the Sinclairs in Scotland, and starting 1317 to 1323. And you get the first visible Rosy Cross order in 1323, but that it actually predates that back to the splitting of the senior order of the Templars, which is the Priory of Sion, and the lower order, which is the adept royals of the Templars, because they lost Jerusalem in 1187. So they have a cutting of the elm tree with that organization as a ceremony in Paris in 1188, and they split away. Now, you have Freemasonry that's going to be created for escaping Knights Templar after 1307, where a lot of Templars scurry over to Scotland with some wealth, not much, but some wealth and some knowledge, probably more knowledge than wealth, because most of the Templar wealth out of France went to Switzerland to be taken care of by a sister organization, the Knights Templar, with the White Cross, which is why you have banking, start of banking and the White Cross imagery in Switzerland. Other assets were taken over by the Montesa Order in Spain, by the set up by the King of Spain at that time. So the church didn't get the assets, and you had a similar thing going on with a Royal Masonic Order being set up to take the assets of the Templars in Portugal. But the French wealth went to Switzerland, and many of the Templars not only went to Switzerland, but were taken into like the Montesa Order and other orders that were created elsewhere. And so the ones that went to Scotland, though, are taken in by Robert the Bruce, who has been excommunicated by the Catholic Church at this point in time for killing his rival in a church. And along with Bruce, who is the de Bruce of the Rollo bloodline of the Norse that migrated over from Normandy after taking Normandy and settling that with the Treaty of St. Clair in about 911 or 912 AD, whom the Sinclairs and the St. Clairs take their royal bloodlines from. It's a royal bloodline. St. Clair is a transliteration of St. Clair, and that's how, what it's called in Scotland. And there's actually a battle partner named St. Clair that's an ancestor to the Sinclairs in Scotland, because that's where he's living. He's a battle partner of Hugh de Payan, who's not listed. St. Clair is not listed in the original nine, but it is in the secret 11 that they like to talk about. And so the Sinclairs sponsor a new organization for these Templar adepts that have escaped. And that's Freemasonry. And that's what is exported to England a little bit earlier in a small dose, but in a majority of the dose with King James in 1600 or so, when he's crowned in England after the death of Queen Elizabeth. So Freemasonry is the lowest level of the initiatory invited bloodline organizations on what they call the Thelemic Tree that I cover off in book two in the hierarchy. And so you get to first level of adept in Freemasonry. And there's many levels of adepthood. Degrees, as they call them, just as education has degrees, because this is a knowledge cult as well as the bloodline cult. Gnosis is Gnosticism. And so you have to be invited to join Freemasonry. And they say the only qualification is, other than you have to be invited, is you have to worship a god. And they're not concerned about which god that you're going to worship. It just has to be a god. So you could worship, you know, Baal. You could worship Allah. You could worship Vishnu. It doesn't matter. Just have to worship a god. And so they start them on pablum, on degrees, which is basically they're lying to the lower level initiates because they're not worthy to know the true meanings to what they're being taught. So they get secondary, third, unimportant sort of allegories that are redefined when they get into adepthood. So the old system of mysticism and secret societies is based on first level adept at third degree. So as you rise up through that level, you become an adept at third degree. That's the York Rite, as you might understand it in terms of Freemasonry today. But so it's the same as the old system. And in about the 1800s, that system was set up mostly in the US, but elsewhere as well, as it was exported, where they took those 3 degrees and split it into 11 other steps to create the 33rd degree of Scottish Rite. So 33rd degree is equal to third degree, first level of adept. And that number is significant for a lot of reasons. Some tell me, and I don't know whether it's true because this is really high up, and you know that the degrees in the old system go up to 33, but nobody ever really gets there because you're basically a god at that point. And then others tell me, well, no, there's almost 100 degrees. And some people say over 100 degrees. But if you took 33 and multiplied that by 3, you'd get to 99. So you're at about that 100 degrees. Same system, just sort of more four steps, and it gets a little bit confusing if you're outside. So you might hear people say, I'm a 32nd degree adept. So you must think, well, they're of the Scottish Rite. Well, that's not possible because you're not adept till you're 33rd degree. And only at the adept level do you get the real secrets, where you start to learn who is the god that you really worship, which they call Lucifer in the secret societies, or the great architect of the universe, as he's also called in Freemasonry, Gnosticism, Zoroastrianism, Mithraism, and other religions, because they're all basically the same root mystical Enochian mysticism. So what's a 32nd degree adept? And I did a show with two Freemasons, and I thought the show went really well, and they were talking, they actually said they're going to do another show, and then they got their hand slapped, and they sent me all sorts of nasty hate mail for a long time, and said they weren't going to publish the first one because they didn't do so well on the show, I guess. So anyways, at the end of that show, he says, well, what would you think if you were talking to a 32nd degree adept? And I said, well, that's not possible unless you're a pureblood. And they said, oh, do tell. And I said, well, you have to be, if you're Scottish, right, it's 33rd degree. It's like football. You don't get a touchdown unless you cross the goal line. The 1 yard line doesn't get you the touchdown. So you have to be full 33rd degree to be the first level. But I said, the Royals, they initiate from childhood. They are an adult. They are an adept before they're an adult, but they can't take their adept title until they're somewhere between 25 and 30 is what I was told. And so at that time, then they can take an adept. And they call themselves a 32nd degree adept. And it's understood within the bloodlines what that means. And so it starts to answer questions about, like, how does Tolkien or Lewis get into Oxford? And then how do they get into a Rosicrucian order of the Golden Dawn in a sponsored Inkling writing society at Oxford if they're not royal, or if they're not initiated? And they'd have to be an adept to be in there. They have to be a high level adept to get in there. Well, that's because they have royal bloodlines. And I have a great document on them and their doctrines, if people want to get a hold of me, where I trace their genealogies back. That's why they're there. And so they were adept. They just weren't claiming it. They weren't there to learn the knowledge. They already had the knowledge to write what they wanted. They were there to learn the writing craft, kind of like Francis Bacon's societies of the Spear Shaker, the Helmet Society, that developed the English language, and where Shakespeare plays and poetry sort of emerged from as well. Another sort of rabbit hole. But just so that people kind of understand, you know, what I'm talking about when we're talking about what a 32nd degree adept is. So Prince James, he's shown as being initiated into Freemasonry, but that's just ceremonial. He was so far beyond first level of Freemasonry adepthood from, you know, when before he was probably 13 years old. I mean, he went in way beyond. And at what level, I don't know. But what I do know is, as you keep going up in the old system, you are getting a higher number of degrees. So understand that Illuminati that would sit at the center of the adepthood in Freemasonry would be higher than third degree or 33rd degree Scottish Rite. And probably even higher, perhaps, than what they would call somebody like a regional manager that would oversee multiple lodges, and they have a specific title for that. They have to be fifth degree in the old system. So you see it starting moving up. So that means Illuminati could be four or five, or could be higher, because the Illuminati is the next trunk organization that's on the tree. And then the Rosicrucians after that. And the Rosicrucians, I'm told, are somewhere around seventh degree. So you can sort of start to see. And if there's 33 degrees or more in that, I mean, who knows how that sort of works as you go up. But there's a lot more degrees to be had. And, I just got an email from somebody who was is part of Freemasonry, and he had a strange experience, and he got a hold of me and he wanted to know what I thought about it. And so he was going through first and second, and he was at second degree. I've asked for a clarification. Is he talking about York Rite or Scottish Rite? Because there's a special thing he was invited back for, where they were going to create all the first and second degrees into adepthood, which means they wouldn't go all the way to 33 from a Scottish Rite. So I'm thinking he was talking about third degree York Rite, where they were going to make them into adepts. And for that, they had a special guest that came in that scared the crap out of him, and that he was called ceremonially a 33 degree royal bloodline adept. And he said ceremonial because technically nobody could be a 33 degree adept in this world, because that's reaching the level of godhood in this world. But what freaked him out was is his eyes were glowing. And he left. He was like violently sick, and he's still freaking out. So I sent him some, you know, information on that, just so that, you know, okay, here's my understanding of it. And if you understand the physical nature to the bloodlines, is that originally not only were they giants, and not only did they look like their parents, but they were called the Shining Ones. Why? Because their eyes glowed. And it would light up a room. So as I understand it, some of those genealogical through the purebloods could still exist. And then others tell me it could be a combination of that and the knowledge that they learn to make themselves closer to God in terms of what they could apply onto themselves, or sort of through the DNA manipulation to reignite that ability to have that glowing, large wraparound eye look that the ancient giants had.
Wow. Yeah, that's mind-blowing. I mean, I suppose your average Freemason, when they join us, has not got a clue about any of this.
No, they don't. They're just there for business relationships and where they can get out of it, right? But you have to be invited. And they only invite people who have either a proven bloodline or genealogical connection, because, you know, as we talked about some of the black nobility that you raised up in Italy, like the Orsini or the Borgia. And in book two, I talk about them a little bit, and more particularly Borgia, particularly as he shows up with the Montesa order and the Jesuits as part of this black nobility of Pope line. But so the black nobility is the bloodline of Italy, and there's two levels. And so you have merchants that come from Phoenicia in the Middle East, say around 1000 AD or so, that start up in there, and they're into Florence and Venice and places like that, that get into banking and trade and those. There's the older black nobility that is the true ancient bloodline. Now, this newer black nobility, on the re-establishment of the Jesuits, it's more of that lower black nobility that puts them back in power in the late 1800s. But the senior black nobility, that is the Julia gens. That's what they call their gene. And it's the gene that I talk about in book one as the gene of Isis, as a generic term, or gene of the mother goddess, because the gene is the one that is passed on new dynasties as a matriarchal start. So you have to have this very special matriarch to pass on the proper gene, and then by inference, the bloodline, the Rh negative bloodline that would be associated with that through the female. And so the Julia gens is the bloodline that goes back to the black nobility, the senior level, the older ones of Italy, to Julius Caesar, Augustus, the senator, royal families, back to Romulus and Remus, and back to those patriarchal godfathers who created Romulus and Remus. So they were giants, Nephilim.
Well, guys, you're getting an education from Gary tonight. I
Yeah.
can assure you.
And
It's such a fascinating topic. It's just
yep. And there's an LB
mind blowing.
Jens. There's an LB Jens that would be connected to the Anjou and the Windsor family. They take most of their genealogy back. And I talk about the LB Jens in book one and book two, but the Julia Jens in book two. And that means LB as in pale or white, as you take that back to Latin, and gens of a specific patriarch. So it goes back to specific patriarchs, both Nephilim and to the angel that would have created them.
Just for people who've never heard of the Black Nobility, Gary's not talking about black people. When we're
Nope.
talking about black nobility, it's because of the black deeds, as I understand it. They're not black people, but their deeds are black. That's what
Yeah,
I've read
they
anyway.
work behind the scenes with their
Yeah.
power, right? And they're considered part of the larger Rex Deus of Europe, the larger community of Western bloodlines.
So, Freemasonry, what influence would you say it still has on the world?
Well, all of the trunk organizations, and I've talked about four of them, so far, actually five with the 13 families at the top, they all have a specific agenda that they were assigned from their beginning at their inception. And it's similar to every royale in the family has a specific role they're obligated to perform from birth. Everybody has a role. Every organization has a role. So they are a trunk organization that oversees a lot of lower level organizations that don't have adept to it. So anything that's in an initiatory society, whether it's an Elks Club or whatever, will have their people working at that level. And it's all to create cover for the larger secret deeds or the black deeds of the adept so that they can work with that sort of invisibility. And so, specifically, the Freemasonic Society was assigned the agenda of working through the army. So that's why you see so much Freemasonry in all forms at the officer level in the army or navy or air force. And the other one is the other obligation that they have is politics. So they're involved at all sorts of politics, and that's why most, presidents in the US were Masons, because that's the sort of end that they were looking at. So if people kind of look at it, how does that sort of come together? If you look at the Revolutionary War in the US, I mean, they're all essentially Freemasons that are signing the Constitution or leading it. Washington is not only a Freemason, but he is also going to be a president, and he's the leader of the Revolutionary Army. So you see that, and all the generals and stuff are the nobility elite from Masonic orders. And so when Benjamin Franklin goes over to try and get money, and he's higher than Freemasonry, he's a member of several other organizations and accepted as a higher level Mason, and the carpet is rolled out for him by the royals in France to get funding. Everything sort of starts to make some sense as to what's going on. So they're going to, work against the rival. The royal bloodline of England to try and maybe get back some of what they already lost to England in the North American wars and other wars around the world. So when the French lost most of their control over North America, so it just starts to show you what they're working with, and they're still active to this day. So in book one, I talk about people who are part of Freemasonry, what they're doing in politics, what the organization is. And you just need to sort of extend that. You could talk endlessly because there are just so many of them and so many organizations, but they all enter in from these branch organizations that come down what I would term as an evergreen tree of Lebanon, as the Thelemic tree with that organizational structure. And these are branch organizations that would have at each branch, as it joins the branch, a center high-level organization, but then it branches down to other ones. And so that hierarchy is built on that branch through all those other organizations back up into the trunk organization. So the Illuminati would have similar branch organizations. The Rosicrucians would have. The Committee of 300 would have. So Davos, IMF, World Bank, Club of Rome, Bilderbergers all come out of the Committee of the 300 families. And then you have the Council of 33 and then the 13 families. So 33 families, 13 families. That's essentially your trunk organizations. And notice the Jesuits weren't anywhere in there.
Yeah. Well, that's.
And I did.
I'm going to leave that for another interview.
Yeah. And I did cover Jesuits in book one because it was too big of a rabbit trail to go down. But they are important. They're just not at the top. And through the black nobility of both the junior and the senior, you can make an argument they would enter in through the banking sort of black nobility at the Committee of 300 or the senior one at the Council of 33 or the 13 families. They would intersect probably at the Committee of 300 or the Council of 33 based on their setup. And they were created by the Rosicrucians. But these were the 33 level at that time before they created the larger 300 below them and then the Rosicrucians. And the Rosicrucians at the top level, it's an intersection of Freemasonry and Illuminati as those ones invited climb up to the lower level of the Rosicrucian order. And then at the top level is purebloods of the Rosicrucian order. So that's the intersection of the Royal Masonic bloodline. So if you look at now, the Order of the Garter or the Order of the Golden Fleece. And by the way, the Golden Fleece was the clothing that the was spun out of for the gods so that their bodies, they could last in those bodies for longer as they took a physical form. And some say the demigods as well, the giants used them to extend their physical life before their body had to leave their counterfeit spirit had to leave them. You have the another one that is so obvious. It comes from the Norse bloodline through Odin, and they call themselves the Knights of the Seraphim. Seraphim are watcher angels, the serpentine angels that created most of the giants before the flood and most of the giants after the flood. And these are dragon angels. And when they took a physical body, they would pass on that DNA. And so that physical look would have went with their offspring. So that's why you have not only gods represented in most of the numbers as serpentine or reptilian of some sort, and the kings of Sumeria, the kings of China, the kings of Sumeria, of Egypt, they're all depicted as serpentine kings because they look like they're celestial mafia godfathers. And so the seraphim show up around the world, you know, as the plumed or feathered serpent with the Kishimaya and throughout North and South America. Classic example of one. And they all, there's many different names for the different gods within each of the countries. You have the Naga gods in India, and of course the dragon creator gods. This is just sort of a sampling of that serpentine celestial mafia council of gods that was ruling the earth and created giants both before and after the flood to do their bidding.
It's so fascinating when we're talking about like these serpentine creatures and dragons, because one of the things I think about is obviously you've got in China, they have like the year of the monkey, the year of the dog and all this. And I've said to people is that, have you got all these real animals and then this one fake one, the dragon, or are they all real? Well, they're all real because dragons were real.
Yeah.
And obviously you've talked about, you know, that these beings were like serpentine. And I've talked a few times about this when it talks about the devil coming into the Garden of Eden, like he wasn't like a snake as we understand it. He would have had legs and sort of walked in because he was a seraphim, wasn't he?
Well, Satan is more than one kind of angel. He has, and I really talk about this in book two. So, yes, in Revelation 12, he's called the devil, Diabolos. He's called a seraphim or a snake. It goes back to Ophes, but in Hebrew, it would be understood as seraphim. And also a dragon or Draconta as a watcher, right? And so he also had seven jewels, so he would have been a high priest of the seraphim as well, that worked before the altar, just as a seraphim worked in the altar and the fiery coals before the altar. But he wouldn't have been biblically, as a lot of people like to assert, the one who deceived Eve, because he's not depicted in the Garden of Eden as a serpent. We get the serpent, which is the Nahash, Hebrew. And that is created as a beast of the field, as Genesis 3:1 talks about. And that would have been created before humans on day six. So this is a walking, talking, intelligent being that is going to work with Satan. But biblically, he is called a cherubim as the one who walked amongst the fiery stones in Ezekiel 28. So he has a cherubic form. He's the anointed cherubim. And he has other descriptions as well. So in Isaiah 14, where he falls from heaven, just as Jesus talks about him in Luke 10, 18, he saw Satan fall from heaven like lightning. He's not Lucifer. That's a corruption of the King James Version Bible by the translators. And the actual word there is Hallel Ben Shachar, Hallel, son of the morning. He's not a morning star. He's the son of the morning. Now, you could interpret that as a morning star. And in that case, he would be like a morning star angel as well. So we get the morning star order shown in Job 38, 4 through 7. You have the sons of God and the morning stars that are there and celebrating at creation. So he's got attributes of that as well. And as you take that back to its Hebrew meaning, you get even more of the meaning of his brightness and the shiningness and the intelligence and the narcissism and all the words that sort of go with it. And so Hallel is probably his name as a morning star. And he would have other names, maybe in the cherubic form. If you were to roll in the book of Enoch, you could get the name Wall of God, which is Gadrael in Hebrew, and an angel named in the book of Enoch as being in Eden. And that probably would have been his cherubic name. In ancient times, kings, priests, and gods would have many names and titles. But Satan was really special that he was above all the other angels, and he had a lot more titles. He was also an archangel, as he's described in the language of the original Greek in the New Testament. So I have a document on these different types of looks. If people want to get a hold of me, I supply documents at no charge. Just tell me the topic and I'll send it off to you. It might take me a month to get back to you, but I will get back to you.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap it up, guys. Me and Gary had some technical issues earlier, and we started 35 minutes late, but Gary's coming back on, fortunately. We've got another session booked. So thanks for all that information, Gary. It's been fascinating. And before we wrap this episode up, could you tell people where they can get your book? Tell us about your website and everything.
Best way to get a hold of me is through my website. That's the Genesis6conspiracy.com with the number 6conspiracy.com. And on that website, there's a contact the author. So if you want to ask me a question or if you want a document, just name the topic. If I've got it, I'll send it to you at no charge. You can also read a generous excerpt of all 98 chapters of book one and all 84 chapters of book two. And these are books that you don't speed read, but they're written in a way because they're such large books and there's so much information in there. So I give a generous excerpt on the website, but it's a small drop in the bucket as to what's in the book and in book two as well. That I did it in a way where every chapter is a mini story. They're about 4 to 5 pages on average, and you can read it at your pace. But if you try and speed read it, your mind is going to go to mush because there's just too much information coming at you and it doesn't stop. So And it's done in a way where you can go back and reread a chapter, because what I talk about each chapter will come up again as the book continues, because it's important. It's laying down a foundation at the beginning is the way I do it, and it all bring you know comes together as you go through the book. So, and on that website as well, if you wanted to get a signed copy, you can get a signed copy by ordering, clicking on book one. And if you're in the US, there's a US page. If you're in Canada, there's a Canadian page. If you're anywhere else in the world, there's an international page. You can pre-order book two. And that is printing's already done and shipped to Amazon and sold out on the first run for the March 12th release date. I expect they're going to start shipping sooner than later. I didn't get my books because of the sellout. There's another run that's in progress and another one behind it. So, but to get a signed copy, I will still send it to you. You just have to wait a little bit longer. I was hoping to get, you know, 500 off the first run to start filling my back orders, but or my pre-orders, but that's going to be another couple of weeks away before I get my books by the looks of it from the email I got from the publisher today. So, so yes, you can order a signed book from me that way. And so again, each for book two, you've got a page for US, Canada, and the rest of the world. So you can also link over from my website to Amazon.com, Amazon.ca, and or BarnesandNoble.com, or over to the Kindle edition. If there's a Kindle edition for each, and I do recommend the Kindle edition for everybody, and the hard copy, because most people want to have it on their shelf with this kind of book. But if you want to find something quickly, because there's so much information, it's really helpful to have a digital version to just pop in the word and get all the entries on that word. I know I use it for my own book, so.
Yeah. No, I've got it on Kindle, your first book. That's what I've been reading it on. I use the Kindle to save some space, or else I'd just be books everywhere. Yeah. But it's been a fascinating chat with you, Gary. And obviously, we have got the second session booked. I think we're probably going to have to book another one, because there's other questions I wanted to ask you. But obviously, with us having technical problems and the time it is now here, unfortunately, I have to wrap this up. So thanks very much, Gary, for persevering when we had those issues. I'll be back next week, guys, with another guest. And Gary's going to be back on the show in a few weeks' time. So thanks again, Gary. I'm Paul, and this is Beyond the Paradigm.
Am I crazy? We don't use that word in here.